Hello, and welcome to the Next Stage Press podcast, where we talk theater and playwriting with the various playwrights of Next Stage Press. I'm your host, Gene Cato, and for the next half hour or so, we'll be speaking with Georgia playwright Daniel Guyton about his routine walk on the dark side of theater, the origins of his wonderful short play, Georgia Gets a Facelift, and the idea that theater shouldn't always be comfortable to an audience. Daniel, hello, and welcome to the podcast.
Hey, Gene, how are you? Thanks for having me.
It is wonderful to talk to you. You're going to be the second person out of the gate. We've had a series of... it's interesting that with you, we're going to be talking a little bit about short plays later on, because this will be the third podcast in a row that 10-minute plays have come up, so I'll be interested to get your take on it and see what your perspective on that is with the previous two playwrights that we've talked about. But
sure.
Before we get to that, I always like to, right out of the gate, just talk a little bit about the playwright themselves. I mean, you know, the purpose of this podcast is for us to kind of not introduced, because people that know your writing know you very well, but again, hopefully we'll hit a broader audience out there. And so start off by just give us a brief history of Daniel Guyton. Tell me, how does a theater guy from Farmingville, New York end up down in the Peach State of Georgia?
Yes. Well, okay, it's a pretty broad question, but basically... I guess I got my start as a writer. I guess I'll go there. It's kind of a broad question. I started out in school, in high school. I was a pretty shy kid. I didn't do a lot of socializing, so I was kind of shy. I had a speech impediment, you know, all this stuff. So I did a lot of writing. Writing was my outlet to the world, my way to communicate and connect. I didn't do a lot of plays. I mostly did poetry and short stories. So that was kind of my thing. I did a lot of cartoon drawing, a little silly stuff, whatever. And then in 10th grade, I was asked to read some of my poetry at a poetry slam at the school. And
oh, wow.
This was nerve-wracking, because I had never really stood in front of an audience before, and it was kind of, you know, I was real shy. So I did it, and there were funny poems, and so I read them, and the audience roared with laughter, and it was like a drug, and I just felt so... amazing, and it felt so great to be on that stage and making people laugh. And I said, I want to do this forever. This is amazing. So I started taking acting classes so that I would have more excuses to be on stage. And I probably should have gone into stand-up comedy, but I didn't think about that at the time. I went into do acting classes, and you know, I started learning, of course, the craft of acting, and I realized there's a lot more to it than just getting laughs. Although I still certainly enjoy that. And so that was fun. And then I got into college, and my original plan was to just go to college to be a writer. That was always sort of the trajectory that everybody expected me to do, was to go into writing. But I started acting as well. And so I started doing a lot of theater. And at some point in my sophomore or junior year, I decided, why not combine my love of writing with my love of acting? And I started writing plays. And I wrote my very first play that... My junior year of college. We got it produced. It was a lot of fun. And the rest, as they say, is history. So I kind of just sort of fell in love with that craft of being able to write plays there. So that's kind of where my playwriting started.
That's interesting that you say that, because, you know, the Arthur Jolly, who did the last podcast that we did, he mm-hmm. started from writing other material as well. He said that he was writing magazine articles and, you know, mm-hmm. other types of stuff. You started with slam poetry and ultimately made your way into the theater. That's very interesting.
Yeah. And some of my plays have a very poetic slam feel to them. So especially some of my early work is very poetic. And so it sort of takes that poetry that I used to write and sort of added it to this dramatic medium. And I do think there is a lot of poetry in playwriting, you know, certainly obviously Shakespeare and Moliere, but even Arthur Miller and Tennessee Williams, there's a lot of poetry there, even if it's not necessarily verse. So that's something I do think there's a shared world between poets and playwrights. Absolutely.
Sure.
Yeah. As far as how I got to Georgia, so I went to college in Albany, New York. I was originally from Long Island, New York, and ended up in Albany, New York for undergraduate. And by the time I graduated, I knew I wanted to go to graduate school. Knew I probably wanted to go into theater because I had developed a severe love of theater by that point, and so I knew that was where I wanted to continue my my craft. And so I looked into a bunch of graduate schools, and the one school that offered me a free ride with an assistantship was the University of Georgia. So I applied to a couple schools, but University of Georgia said, "We will pay you to come here with a teaching assistantship." So I said, "Yes." So I came down to Georgia, and that was my first trip to Georgia. So I was here for about 3 years, my MFA. While here, I met a really good friend of mine named Clay Martin. And after graduate school, I moved back to New York for a short time to pay off some debts and do whatever I had to you know, kind of get myself back on my feet.
Sure.
You know, when you leave college, even with a free ride, I still had, you know, debt. You're still not making a whole lot of money.
Always.
Right, exactly. So, you know, I got myself back on my feet, living up in New York. And through this friend, Clay, I ended up meeting my wife online. And she was from Georgia. She went to high school with him. I went to college with him. So he sort of introduced us. And
boy, there's a little bit more. There's some life poetry going on right there, isn't there?
Yeah, exactly. So through a series of events, we had a bit of a long distance thing while I was up in New York. It wasn't anything serious because we lived so far away. But then life brought me to Tampa, Florida. So I lived in Tampa, Florida. That was much closer to Georgia. So at that point, we were about 7 hours away. So we did the long distance thing for about 7 hours for about half a year. And then decided we wanted to live closer. So I ultimately moved here for love.
Well, that's that's a wonderful reason to move someplace. Terrific. That's all those roads and stuff like that all seem like that they were all leading to the same place, which is ultimately cool. So that's cool.
Absolutely.
Yeah. You've been there ever since. Yeah.
I have, I moved here in 2008. Actually moved here just as the economy was crashing. I had a really good job down in Tampa. I was a store manager, making pretty decent money, benefits, all that. And, you know, I was like, you know what? I love this girl. I'm going to go up there. I'm going to live with her. It's going to be great. We're going to, you know, get married eventually. So I quit my job. And a week later, Wachovia Bank or one of those banks just collapsed. They just went under. I forget which bank it was, but it was just all over the news. And it was just the steamroll effect and the entire world's economy just collapsed right after I quit my job. Maybe I should rethink this. I don't know. But we decided, you know what, let's just go ahead. And I moved up here. And it was actually really funny because for the first maybe 5-6 months, I could not find work. So here's my introduction to my girlfriend's, you know, my then girlfriend's family, and they think I'm this bum who can't get a job, you know, because of the economy had just crashed, you know. So I finally, of course, did find work, you know, and everything's been fine since. But for the first 6 months of our relationship, I was a broke, unemployed guy. Total starving artist. And my girlfriend's family thought that I was, you know, just, you know, but it of course turns out I, you know, did finally get work and everything's been great since.
Before we dive into your work, because, you know, what's the theater communities like there in Georgia? You know, Georgia's not typically known to be, you know, you know, on the, I guess what I would say, and certain parts are, of course, but I mean, they're mm-hmm. it's not yeah. the first state that you think of whenever it comes to theater. So what's the theater climate like in Georgia for, you know, for folks that might be thinking about going to grad school or school out there or, you mm-hmm. know, anything? What's the theater climate like out there?
Atlanta has a pretty healthy theater scene. There's a lot of theaters to choose from. In fact, one of the hardest things in my world, I love to go see a lot of theater. I have a lot of friends in the area that I love to support that are all actors and writers and stuff. It is really hard to see everything because there's so much to see here. We've got a mix from, you know, everything from community theater all the way up to very professional theaters. In fact, we have the Alliance Theater here, which is the only theater in Atlanta to have ever won a Tony for Best Regional Production.
Fantastic.
So they actually, yeah, and they do a lot of world premieres here at the Alliance Theater, also Horizon Theater. Mm-hmm. A lot of their shows have started here and then gone on to Broadway and gone on to do other big things. So this is usually a pretty decent breeding ground to determine if something will be a success up north. So a lot of shows do come here to Atlanta first. And we got a lot of very professional work. A lot of the pretty well-known national people have started here in Atlanta and then gone on to do bigger and better things. Kenny Leon is a famous director up in New York. He's done a lot of Broadway shows. He started here in Atlanta. Topher Payne is a famous playwright and screenwriter, and he started here in Atlanta. He's still in Atlanta. So we've been a pretty decent breeding ground for a lot of very talented people as well.
Cool. That's good because, yeah. You know, Georgia has gotten here in the past couple of years, it's gotten known for film and for television, you know,
yeah.
Of course,
you right.
know, with The Walking Dead and all that films there and all that.
Mm-hmm.
But that's ultra cool to hear about all the theater stuff that's going on out there. Okay.
Yeah,
well,
I've been very, very pleased.
Let's talk about you. All right. Now, I'm going to ask you about this. You know, again, like I said, anyone that knows you is going to know that you kind of write in your own particular Daniel Guyton writing style. You've got kind of your own fingerprint.
Right.
So most of your work that has some somewhat dark overtones to it. So I'm just going to ask you, what is it that draws you to that type of theater? And why do you think audiences are intrigued by it? Because you have a couple of short plays that are in one of your collection that keeps these same productions of these same plays keep getting up. It's a little play called I'm Not Gay that seems like that it keeps getting productions all over and people are just loving it. And you've got this wonderful dark comedy, you know, that you write through. So tell me about that. What is it about dark theater that you love so much?
It's I'm not sure why. I'm a pretty happy guy overall. I'm a pretty upbeat, optimistic person. But I do find humor in the macabre. In my life, we've had a lot of, death in the family and a lot of, just loss. But we've always developed a pretty healthy sense of humor about it. It's sort of the thing that keeps you going. If you can laugh at the tragedy in life. But we've lost a number of very prominent family members in my life. My dad died when I was 4 months old. I was very young when he died. And,
oh wow!
So we've had death and tragedy throughout my life. But again, my parents instilled in me a very healthy sense of being able to laugh even when things are terrible. And so I've sort of adopted that in my writing style. I sort of find ways to laugh through the pain. And so a lot of my material has this dark element, but there's laughter throughout because I think that is essential to dealing with the things that are difficult to understand. In fact, a lot of my writing, I specifically, if there's an issue that bothers me, I'll see something in the news and somebody behaves some horrible way and did something terrible to somebody. And I read that, I'm like, why would a person do this? I want to write about that person and understand why they would do this horrible thing. And so I'll write it and often it'll somehow become funny because that's my way of dealing with how horrific this behavior is. And so that's kind of, I guess, a coping mechanism, I guess, maybe to find a way to laugh at this terrible event.
Do you think that audiences are kind of drawn to that whole thing? I guess just because of the hilarious tragedy that life can be sometimes. I mean, do you think that those audiences are just kind of drawn to that because of the same reason?
I think so. I get a mix. I get a mixed response. Some people love my work and some people hate it. And I think it has to do with their own ability to see life in that absurdity. Some people go, well, this is not something to ever be laughed at. How dare you laugh at such a thing? And then other people go, oh my God, I'm so glad I was able to laugh at that because otherwise I'd go crazy.
Right.
And I think, different people respond differently. I've never been one to have a universal adoration of my audience. I typically have, people that just absolutely love my work and then people who are just like, ugh, I can't stand him, and I've sort of embraced that. That's just part of who I am.
Well,
and,
about it too much, Daniel, because I think William Shakespeare probably has the exact same problem.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know,
sure,
so you're in
sure.
good company.
I'm sure he does.
Yeah.
Right.
All right. Well, that's a great transition. That's a great transition going into this, because I'm going to single out one of your plays here and get you to talk about it a little bit. Because my very first association with your work was a wonderful short play that you wrote called Georgie Gets a Facelift, which is part of your Hilarious Nightmare collection. And out there, anyone listening to this, Daniel has got two collections that are out there, Hilarious Nightmares and Hilarious Nightmares 2, which both are collections of short plays. And this Georgie Gets a Facelift is in the first one, Hilarious Nightmares. Mm-hmm. And I want you to talk a little bit about what inspired that work, because, I mean, you talk about, you know, death and hilariousness and tragedy and all that stuff rolled in. You have three characters, a suicidal young man, his mother, and a Girl Scout who kind of raps on the wrong door at the wrong time. So can you tell us a little bit about what got Georgie Gets a Facelift out onto page?
Sure, sure. Well, that's actually a perfect example of, you know, how I was saying sometimes things don't make sense. So you try to find humor to deal with the horrific stuff. Well, I mentioned my father died when I was 4 months old. To this day, it's still an unsolved death. It is. He died. He was in the service. The reason it's unsolved is because at first it was ruled a suicide. But then certain pieces of evidence came out and they thought, well, actually, he might not be a suicide. So it might have been a murder. So it was a gunshot wound. He died of a gunshot wound. Officially on the books, it is an unsolved murder. But there are people in my family, some who believe it's suicide, some who believe it was a murder. Nobody can come to a 100% consensus of this. But for a good portion of my childhood, I believed he had committed suicide. So that was sort of a, you know, this awareness of this. And then Georgie Gets a Facelift, this character is dealing with the fact that his father had committed suicide years before. So sort of like my very dark way of dealing with this tragic death that I didn't really understand in my own family. And in that play, the mother is sort of also coming to grips with the fact that her husband committed suicide in that play. And then Georgie is feeling very depressed and he's trying to commit suicide, but he keeps failing at that. And where that came from was, I was in a pretty dark place in my life, in reality. And I thought, you know, I don't think I was ever actually suicidal, but I was at a point where I thought, you know what, my life is so screwed up. I bet you if I tried to commit suicide, I'd screw that up too. You know, I thought, that's a really funny line. That's a really funny image of this guy. And again, it's dark. I'm not trying to make light of suicide. I think it's a horrible thing for somebody to feel that way and want to do that to themselves. But again, I was looking at my own world and thinking, you know, how ridiculous it would be if somebody tried to do this and failed at it repeatedly. And so that's sort of where the comedy of that play comes from, is this person wanting to hurt themselves and just not even being able to do that right. And as I'm explaining this, of course, it sounds horrible, and I'm sure people are hearing this going, I don't want to read that. That sounds terrible. But finding a way to make that funny and make that hilarious for an audience was an interesting thing, and it was a very healthy coping mechanism for me in writing that, because I was able to sort of, again, examine my own father's mysterious death, look at my own feelings of depression at the time, sort of make it into an absurdist, you know, piece, and sort of examine all these strange emotions that I was feeling at that moment. And audiences responded. People have told me it's one of my funniest plays. And as dark as that sounds, it gets a lot of laughs every time it gets produced. So, you know, it's just one of those examples of taking something that is really upsetting to me and concerning and just really bothers me, and then taking it and finding humor in it to sort of, I guess, lighten the mood or find that macabre humor in it, the gallows humor, I suppose you'd call it.
Yeah.
And so that's probably the clearest example in my work of being able to take something that really upsets me and making it funny.
Well, it is a very funny, funny play. And I think that everyone, if you, again, go out, grab a copy of Hilarious Nightmare so that you can read it on the page, because it's wonderful. Now, also kind of going into this, Georgie Gets a Facelift was made into a short film. So tell us a little bit about the process that went along into turning it into a short film.
Well, we had a production in Texas. They produced in Dallas, Texas. It was the Church Mouse Productions. They did it in Texas back in 2010, and it was very successful. It won a lot of awards down there and got a lot of great reviews from it. And the main actor said, I really want to turn this into film. He had a film crew or a bunch of friends with cameras, equipment, and stuff. And so they actually turned it into a movie. Well, at first they turned it into a trailer, and they used the trailer to try to raise funds. Unfortunately, the funding didn't fall through. So right now all we have is a trailer of it. We don't actually have the full movie.
Oh, I see.
So, yeah, and then the actor, I think he went on to some other big projects, and he just kind of, I'm not sure if he lost interest or, you know, I'm still interested in making it to a film, but at this moment it's just a
it's just
trailer.
A trailer, right? Well, there's so much in that, and now that jogs my memory. That's right, I remember that now. The trailer, that was put together. It feels like it tells so much of the story.
Yeah, they did a great job of the trailer. I love it. You can find it on YouTube if you're interested in looking at the trailer. You can go on YouTube, just look up Georgia Gets a Facelift trailer, and you'll see it's got Joey Folsom in it and some other really talented people. They did a great job with that trailer.
Yeah, funny. And that trailer alone is going to make theater companies want to produce the play. Just watching the Girl Scout flopping around has got to be some. All right.
Yeah.
Well, that's a good segue. Let's go into – you have a lot of these 10-minute plays that are produced. This has been a running theme with the last two playwrights that we've talked to. What is it about short plays that appeals to you?
They're a lot more challenging to write than a lot of people realize. So there is a challenge in being able to take a full story. I mean, there has to be a complete story. There has to be a character going through a change. They have to want something and then in 10 minutes discover whether they're going to get what they want. So there is a lot to it, but you've got to condense it into a small little package. It's almost like painting the Sistine Chapel on the head of a pin. You know, you've got to take this actual full play and just find the barest elements to it and make it 10 minutes. So there's a lot of cutting. You know, you rewrite the story, then you got to cut back a lot and trim back to make it really tight and fit. So that is a really interesting challenge. I love the challenge of that. The other thing with 10 minutes is they're very inexpensive to produce. And so my 10 minutes get a lot more productions than my full lengths.
Right.
So, just because they're very easy to produce, usually they cost almost nothing. Many times the actors are willing to volunteer for it. You know, I personally, of course, love when everyone gets paid, but for a lot of 10-minute festivals, they do for fundraisers and whatnot. People volunteer their time, and so they get produced a whole lot more. So there's an appeal in that way, just from a commercial perspective, to get my name out there more and I've gotten a lot of my full lengths produced because somebody did my 10 minutes in a festival and said, oh, I really like your work. Can I read more? And so that it sort of is a great, almost like a business card, you know, like
sure.
they do a short piece and they get to say, you know, well, we want to see more of what you have to offer. So it's a great introduction in terms of that. But also, like I said, you know, you can get a whole lot of productions. I have one play called Death of a Snowman, which has received its 96th production this year. So it's one of the things where, you know, if it's a well-done piece, you know, people will want to produce it over and over again. So it's kind of nice. And plus, you know, I wrote a lot of these when I was working, as a teacher. It's really time-consuming to write a full-length play, and I don't always have a lot of free time. So I get to do my 10 minutes, you know, on my weekends or whatever when I'm in the middle of teaching.
Right.
And then the full lengths I work on over the summer when I'm off. So, yeah.
All right. Well, that's a great answer. Yeah. And that's the first time that I've ever heard anyone talk about a 10-minute play being a calling card, but you're absolutely right. I mean, it's a good way to get your work in the door in order to get the full lengths possibly done. All right, that's a great transition because moving on to the next question that we've got here it's an announcement and then it moves into a question. We are very, very pleased to announce on this podcast that Next Stage Press has just received the rights from you for one of your latest full-length plays that was it's been produced recent it was produced in Georgia, and then it had a recent production down in Houston with Cone Man Running Productions. Three Ladies yep. of Orpington is going to be published on October the 1st, so we've got a little over a month here from the time that we're recording this podcast.
Right.
I read it's up for a couple of awards. You're gonna you're gonna find that out in about a week from now, whether or not
That's
it's
right.
won. Correct.
Yes,
okay,
indeed.
Good. And the so we'll look forward to find out the results of that. It has been described as what was it, Jane Austen meets Edgar Allan Poe. Is that correct?
yeah.
And so yeah. My question on that is that the period piece nature of this full-length play of yours is a little different for you than it seems, but your signature style still runs through the piece. Can you tell us a little bit about the genesis of that project? And again, you know, that project is so different from like Georgie Gets a Facelift or, you know, anything. So here we've got this wonderful period piece. How does Daniel Guyton write a period piece in the same voice?
Sure. Yeah, that was a challenge. That was a hard one to write, but I had a lot of fun with it. I got to give a shout out to my buddy L. Marcus Williams. He's a New York-based director. He does a lot of films and some theater. He had directed a couple of my plays up in New York. You know, really great guy. We've gotten along very well. And one day he was like, hey, I've got this great idea for a play. I'm not really a writer, you know, but if you're interested in writing it, I'd love to produce it. And, you know, we kind of talked about this idea. And I said, sure, you know, let's talk about it. And so he pitched this idea. And it was fantastic. And of course, in the play, he gets, you know, story credit because it is his idea. I fleshed out the characters. I wrote all the dialogue. I kind of came up with the whole, how the play, you know, works and how all pieces connect. But he came up with the with the genesis of the seed of the idea. And in his idea, we have three women who are in Victorian era England where, you know, women don't have a lot of power. You know, just by the nature of society at the time. Mm-hmm. And these three women, all the men in their life have gone. They've died, they've died off, whatever. And so there's a mother, daughter, and a grandmother. They're living together, and they're trying to figure out how are we going to make ends meet? Because we've got, you know, we've got bills to pay. We've got all, you know, food to put on the table. We've got, at one point they had servants. They don't have any servants anymore because they've got no money. And what are they going to do? How are they going to survive? And then... In his premise, a mysterious stranger shows up, and the stranger shows up, and they think everything's going to be wonderful now. He's going to save the day because he's, you know, wealthy, and he's going to marry the youngest daughter and, you know, kind of bring them back to a station of prominence. But it turns out that this mysterious person actually has secrets of his own and may not be there for the best of intentions. And as he's pitching this idea, I'm like, you know what? I actually really am into this. This is a really cool storyline, and I could see how this ties in. And then, of course, he pitched me, and I don't want to say it over the podcast because I want people to read it, but he pitched me the ending that he saw, and I was like, ooh, yeah, that's cool. You know, that was the part that hooked me was you know, how he imagined it ending. And again, I don't want to reveal that here, but,
sure.
But it was a really cool twist that I just loved. And so I said, yeah, I want to do this. So I sat down to write, and actually the first three or four scenes came very quickly. I was able to type those out very, very quickly. And the current draft, that we're publishing is pretty intact from what those first three scenes were. Where it became difficult is when I got to about the second half of the show, I did not know how to end it, where I was going to go with it. I knew the ultimate ending, but I didn't know how I was going to get to that ending because, you know, where I started and where I was going to go. And ultimately, what finally happened in a flash of inspiration was I came up with a fifth character. So in his initial pitch, he had told me about these four characters. It suddenly dawned on me we needed a fifth character in there. And that fifth character, I don't want to reveal it because it sort of shows up towards the end. But once I found out I wanted to add that character in, the whole arc of the play just took shape. And so this fifth character just adds a whole new life to the ending of the piece that just sort of brings it all together. So that was a fun process. But it took about 3 years to write it. Because
that's quite a process.
That initial part was so quick, but then I I had a writer's block wall. I could not figure out how to wrap it up. And I ended up putting it aside for a while, for about 2 years. And then finally one day I just sat down and was like, oh, I know how to fix it. And, you know, it's like a flash of inspiration. And that was off to the races after that.
Sure. All right. You brought about this fifth character. This fifth character in Orpington has a certain reveal in it that might cause a squeam to run through the audience. We won't reveal it because we want people to get the play and read it. But your response to a recent comment that was posted about that was that theater isn't always meant to be comfortable. So tell us about your position on that.
Well, yeah, I mean, we want people to sit in the audience. Now, obviously, we don't want them running out of the door screaming. We don't want them to not come back to the theater. We want them to be, I guess, somewhat comfortable, but at the same time, we want them to feel things. We want them to laugh. We want them to cry. We want them to kind of, you know, pull back in horror at certain scenes. And if we're too comfortable, you know, people will just take a nap, you know, and that's not really what theater is about. Theater is I want audiences to sit on the edge of their seat and to react and to feel things when they watch a play, whether it's my play or any play. If I'm at a theater, I want to feel things. And if I'm not reacting and feeling things, then I often walk out and go, it's all right. You know, it's okay. But if a play makes me feel something, then I usually walk out with a much better experience. And I think if we're too comfortable, then, you know, I don't know. I think we get bored. So I really like keep people on the edge of the seats and not knowing what they're about to see and you know, kind of, again, feeling things. So I think that's very important.
Well, I can say this having read, you know, a lot of your work, that I think you're a master at that. So, yeah, well, I do. I mean, it's so much fun to read stuff that, I mean, I think in reading your plays, I have just about I've had just about every emotion that I possibly can have. I think
that's wonderful. I love that.
Yeah. And it's, and every one of your plays, like I said, even though they have this signature style, every one of them has their own different fingerprint. So, you know, all of them, you're going to walk away with a different experience, but whenever you read one of your plays, you're certainly going to have an experience. I can attest to that. Okay. We're kind of coming up on our time here, but I want to ask you one last question. What can you tell us about The Mother of God Visits Hell and The Legend of Steel City?
Okay. Yeah. So The Mother of God Visits Hell is actually sort of an adaptation. I was reading The Brothers Karamazov by Dostoevsky, and which is a wonderful, wonderful novel. If you never read it, it's very dense, it's very literary, very complicated piece of literature. But basically, in the story of The Brothers Karamazov, there are three brothers who are trying to solve the murder of their father. So at its very heart, the plot of that book is a murder mystery. They're trying to figure out who killed their father. You know, metaphorically, it's rife with metaphor, especially religious metaphor. And ultimately, you know, I mean, there's plenty of books written on this subject, but ultimately the father figure represents God. And these three men, these three brothers, are trying to figure out how they feel about God. Is God dead? Is he alive? And so there's a whole slew of metaphor there. And one of the brothers is an atheist, one of the brothers is a monk, and one of them is trying to decide how he feels about God. So there's like the two extremes, what's the one right in the middle? And so they're trying to figure out this thing. In the course of it, the one who's a monk talks about this poem that he read from the ancient 8th century Greeks about the Virgin Mary traveling to hell to comfort the souls of the damned because she feels so sorry that they're in suffering, and so she wants to go and comfort them. And when she goes there, she feels so sorry for everything that she sees that she begs God to release all the souls and to not send anyone to hell. And I thought that was such a beautiful, beautiful thing. And I thought, well, I want to read this poem because, you know, in Dostoevsky's novel, he just describes the poem. He doesn't actually write it out. So I was like, I want to read this poem. So I went and looked and I can't find it. And I realized he actually made it up for the novel. So that poem actually doesn't exist. It's something he made up for the novel. And I was like, well, I am going to write it. So I started writing a poem of it. And then I was like, well, you know, I'm actually much better at writing plays. So let me write a play of it. And I wrote it in verse. So I wrote it in iambic pentameter. And so the entire play is written the way I would imagine a poem to have been written in that time, or the way I would imagine they would have written it if had they written it in that time period.
So
it's an iambic pentameter, really? It's in poetry. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so it's a play, but it's in poetry, it's in verse, and it rhymes. It's all in rhyming verse. I'm not bragging in any way. People have told me it's like Milton, Paradise Lost. That's what they feel when they read it. So, and again, I don't mean that in a bragging way, like I'm as good as Milton. I just mean that people have felt similarly when they've read it, which is my intention. I wanted it to feel like it was old English when I wrote it. So,
oh my gosh, Daniel, if I were to ever write that, I would tell everyone, well, you know what? People have said that it's as good as Milton, and I don't know if I've mentioned, but I've also collaborated with Dostoevsky.
Yeah, right, exactly. Maybe I need to start pitching it that way. Right. Yeah, that's a good idea. So that's that play, and it was really fun. It's gotten a lot of readings, a lot of stage readings. A lot of people are, I think, scared of it. It's had two productions, but both of them were back in 2009. It's had no productions since then, even though it's won several awards. It's had a lot of readings. I don't know. I think it's maybe the language is off-putting for some, or maybe the title called "The Mother of God Visits Hell." I think it's a beautiful premise for trying to help these people, but I think some people think there might be blasphemous, and it's really not. It's actually very, very reverential, and I tried to be reverential when I wrote it.
Right.
I'm very proud of it. It took a long time to write that one because of all the verse.
I can imagine.
Yeah. So that one's been challenging, but I'm extremely proud of it, and I would love somebody to want to produce that one again. So that's that one, and then the most recent play I've written is called "The Legend of Steel City." And it is a steampunk play. It's all about, this fictional world called Steel City. And the characters are dealing with a steel shortage. And they're trying to get extra metal for the city. And it's really, if you know anything about steampunk, the visual elements are the most important part of that. And so the storyline connects to these visual elements. But it's another one I'm very proud of. It has not been produced yet. It's brand new. So it's just out there now, trying to get somebody to produce it at this time.
Well, we're going to be looking for that. So tell us a little bit. How can people reach you? Do you have a website? Are you on social media?
Yeah, fill us in. I am, sure. I do have a website. It's www.dangeitan.com. It's funny. I started this website years and years ago. Professionally, I always prefer to go by Daniel Guyton, just because there is a Dan Guyton in England who's a musician, and so I don't want to necessarily get confused with him, although he's very talented, but we're different people. And so I always tell everybody I'm Daniel Guyton professionally, but my website was started so long ago, it is danguyton.com. And I am on social media, and my Twitter handle and also my Facebook page are twitter.com/DGuyton21, and my Facebook page is also facebook.com/DGuyton21.
Okay, well, good. We'll have to get some updates on The Mother of God Visits Hell and The Legend of Steel City. Well, that's all the time that we have for this episode. If you'd like to purchase any of Daniel's plays, they are available on Amazon.com, and you can read the first half of his plays or any of Next Stage Press works on our website at www.nextstagepress.net. Also, if you're hearing this podcast for the first time, you can find the other episodes on iTunes or Podomatic. Just search Next Stage Press and hit subscribe. And as always, they're free to listen to and free to share with the world through the wonderful marvel of social media. Join us next time when we talk to Texas playwright Amanda Bishop Guthrie about writing historical-based short plays and the Texas University Interscholastic League statewide play competition for middle schoolers and high schoolers, or better known as UIL. Until then, keep writing plays, keep reading plays, and keep going to the theater and supporting new work. And as always, Daniel, thank you so much for spending amount of time with us, buddy.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
All right. Goodbye, everybody.